Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
Welcome to the main course. It's Sunday. I'm Patrick Martins. That was really nice of Brandon to say how awesome they are at Roberta's, but we hate Roberta's today because we are competing with Roberta's today as we are with 10 other teams.
Yeah.
It's a drinking competition. Jack, you and I are two of the five representatives on the team, and I hope you're taking this drinking competition very seriously.
From the moment I heard it.
Man, this is a three... category competition. There's the precision round, of which only six teams move forward. There's the power round, which only three teams move forward. And then, of course, as everyone can imagine, the glory round, which is the five-legged race around Bushwick where all team members compete. So,
awesome.
Yes, I actually am not feeling that well from last night and drinking, but I think we're going to have a good showing today.
Like you said, hair of the dog, right?
Hair of the dog.
That's how we're going to do it.
So we have actually a very interesting show, surprisingly, based off of that introduction. You would not think it's going to be an interesting show, but it actually will be.
And it's news time.
We're going to do Week in Review. We'll also have an interview with Paul Bertoli, who is a titan of gastronomy in America. And then we're going to have the five people who are competing in the Roberta's drinking competition. They will come in to close out the show. So, Week in Review, Jack.
So,
take it away.
First, we're having a holiday party. I'm not sure if listeners are not aware because we haven't told listeners. So,
no.
We'll announce it right now. We're having a holiday party this Thursday at Tandem in Bushwick, keeping true to our Bushwick roots.
And it's open, you know, at 8 o'clock, basically. It opens to the public. And anyone can come and meet the 28 hosts of the 28 shows on Heritage Radio Network. Tell us about Tandem. Where is it? What is it?
It's a cool place. 236 Troutman Street between Wilson and Knickerbocker. I actually throw some music events there once a month, so I'm pretty familiar with the spot. Really cool staff. They've used Heritage product before. They've got a cool menu. They do... I think Indian food on Sundays.
And that woman like built that place single-handedly, right?
Yeah, her and her man, I believe.
Yeah, they literally, like, they are strong. Their hands are, you know, crusty with all the work they've done. But she does stained glass. She does, like, wood things. I mean, she's a very interesting lady, and it's a very interesting place. Well, that's exciting. So that's this Thursday.
This Thursday.
It'll be open to the public at 8 o'clock.
Exactly. Yeah. And, I encourage anybody that listens to come by and hang out.
Next.
So this is a show that you actually, I know, listen to and were fascinated by, being a meat market man yourself.
Mm-hmm.
On A Taste of the Past, Linda had Gurgly Bisik.
Now, Taste of the Past is a show that airs, what is this,
Thursdays at noon, right. It's a culinary history show.
Yeah, and it looks to the past. So today, this show, wasn't it from like markets from 1770 to like 1860 or something like that?
Yeah, actually around like 1811 to 1892.
Okay.
And, you know, markets were a very big deal back then because refrigeration was an issue. You know, homes didn't have refrigeration as they do now. So people would shop at these markets, you know, upwards to 6 days a week.
Hmm. Yeah, well, it's funny. The public market concept, it just doesn't exist that much in the States. I mean, we have a shop at Essex Street Market, and it's funny. Still, most people don't wake up in the morning and think, let me go to the public market for my cup of coffee and croissant, or let me go to the public market for a quick sandwich and an espresso, and then let me just zip over to the market before it closes and pick up a piece of chicken and a and you know, a bottle of wine or something like that. And so, it's a very it's very interesting to hear that show. What was his name?
Gregory Baik.
It's spelled like it sounds.
Right.
And he is a professor at Columbia University, right, about urban studies?
Yes, I believe so.
And, you know, really interesting guy. And just to think that people, because of lack of refrigeration especially, but also just culturally, 5-6 times a week they would go to the market. He also said that the city used to certify butchers. So you were not allowed to open a butcher shop unless the city certified you. And I think you needed 5 or 6 years of experience. So it was, you know, a real craftsman giving you a real quality product back then. And that was the quality control kind of thing. And then I think in the 1830s or 40s, they changed that. Then any idiot like myself could open a butcher shop and, you know, serve people. But yeah, it's very, very interesting. Markets were absolutely 100% at the center, heart, core of everybody's life.
Yeah, and you'd hope we can move back to a market-based, you know.
Thanks, Jack. Thing. I'm looking forward to seeing you there tomorrow morning.
That's right. Buying something.
Buying something for sure. So tell us what else. So that was a really good show. Thanks to Linda. She always has such interesting guests.
Always, yeah. It's a fascinating show. And
it's one of my top 28 favorite shows on the network.
What an honor. I want to continue also on
By the way, in that same vein, Jack, you'd like my new sandwich policy.
What's that?
At the meat shop. If ours is not one of the top 7 sandwiches you've had today, your money back.
Ooh. I'm going to have to take you up on that.
Yeah, but you might also have to eat 8 sandwiches. Do you see? No one will never have to produce on that unless the person's had 8 sandwiches and that we were the worst.
Or you can buy 8 sandwiches from the meat shop and get one of them free.
Oh, interesting. Brilliant. I'm ruined.
So Erica Wides kind of continued on the theme of Thanksgiving leftovers. And like I said last week, this is kind of close to me because my family was guilty of this, you know. I brought them the Heritage turkey, and they said, it's kind of small. So they went to the supermarket and bought another commodity turkey breast. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it turns out the Heritage turkey was enough for everybody, and they had this big, disgusting turkey breast leftover. So Erica had a very disturbing statistic about Thanksgiving leftovers in this country, and I want to play it right now.
Wow.
So while we're all busy, you know, putting our empty cans and bottles in the recycling bin after our big Thanksgiving meal, just think about this. 35% of the Thanksgiving turkey meat that's purchased in the U.S. during the holiday doesn't get eaten. 35% of it gets thrown away. I mean, they've never even heard of turkey in Afghanistan, and we're throwing away a third of it.
So you can imagine she goes on.
It's an outrage, she says.
Yes.
Well, Erica Wides is a fountain of information for the network. She's probably 35% of all Daily Bites, that we get Daily Bites from her. Her show is called Let's Get Real.
Yeah.
And she broadcasts, what, Mondays at 6:30?
Tuesdays at 6:30. I mean, what do you think about that? You know, 30% of all that turkey is not even being eaten. And it's like we've been preconditioned. We want the big turkey out of the oven. Everybody thinks they want leftovers because it sounds like a great idea, but nobody eats those leftovers, you know?
There's two things. One is I don't know if she's including the bone weight of the turkey.
Okay.
And then the other thing, she's also just cutting it off at Thanksgiving and not talking about the day after, and maybe some of those leftovers.
No, she's saying that 30% of it actually never gets eaten.
Never gets eaten.
Right. Thrown out or gone bad or...
Well, yeah. Anne is a very good leftover person. She's constantly trying to recycle stuff. I mean, there's certain things that I just would never eat leftover. Bread.
Ugh.
Chinese food.
Ugh.
But then other things like pizza and pasta, you know, fried pasta can be super delicious, but that is actually really outrageous. 35% of food is leftover. I also wonder what is the percentage across the board?
Mm.
Like what percentage of, bought food ends up getting never eaten?
Yeah.
That'd be a good statistic.
True.
Well, she is just great. And, you get to hear a lot of the content that Erica brings up on our Daily Bites, which are little 45-second bits, food bites that Jack Inslee and Katie Kiefer put together every Wednesday. So, she's a really great show and also one of my top 28 favorite shows on the network.
Wow, awesome.
Yeah, special.
So then a few quick plugs, other stuff that happened on the station this week. Garrett Oliver announced a collaboration at Brooklyn Brewery with Ama Bianda, and I was lucky enough to taste it. It's a Birra Arginale da Tavola. You can check the tags on Beer Sessions for that.
Artigianale.
There you go.
Artisan?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Da Tavola.
Nice. And
it's a very light beer, really perfect for food pairing, and that's kind of what he said before I tasted it, but I did taste it, and it's very true, very easy beer to drink. It was very fascinating, because Italian beers are very expensive, because they tax them differently on the export from Italy, so if you try to buy a craft Italian beer in this country, you may pay upwards to like $12 for a small bottle, so it's very hard for people to taste Italian beer, and this is kind of cool, because, you know, it'll make it more accessible to people.
Very interesting. I love the Italians. They're always partnering. I remember when I lived in Italy, they were like, oh, you're an American. What city are you from? And I'm like, New York City. They're like, oh, because my little town of Salerno is partnered with Phoenix. We are brother and sister cities. I'm like, what? What happens? Anyway, it is really nice to see artisans collaborate. It's actually a really subversive and powerful way for lesser known beers, you know, or not the big boy beers, you know, to kind of get some more traction, you know, artisans collaborating. I mean, that's a good thing. So yeah, good for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And then one more quick plug. A good friend of Damon Bolte was on his show to announce the opening of a new bar in Williamsburg called Basic. And that's B-A-S-I-K.
Where is it?
And that's
what is it?
You see the address. It's 323 Grand Street. And I kind of liked his pitch for it. He was like, you know, if you want to come try some interesting new cocktails in the cocktail scene, come on by. Or if you want to drink vodka and Sprite with your college buddies, we'll welcome you just the same.
Wow, interesting. For people who don't know, within the very elite cocktail girl and guy world, vodka is not a popular drink. Because it tastes of nothing.
Right.
So it's
and they
not
say
really...
That, they say that it doesn't prove you're a good bartender because anybody can mix anything with vodka and you wouldn't even know.
Exactly. As I didn't know as I had my 20 shots with Anne's... There was a wedding shower for the girls, and then there was a bachelor bath, I guess, is what to call it, for the guys. And we drank a lot of vodka. And the scary thing about vodka, you really do not notice that you're drinking it. You just could drink 50 little cold shots and not really register anything. But, you know, with a good, powerful drink, you only need one or two of them. And you're like, whoa, I feel its effects. So cool. Well, it sounds like it's been an interesting week.
As always, yeah. Absolutely.
Any other things, Jack, you need to report?
We were lucky enough to have a competitive eater on the network for the first time. His name is Crazy Legs Conti, and he's competed in the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest and Corn on the Cob Contest, all different types of contests, and it was really fascinating. He's a huge guy, first of all, to begin with. But, you know, he kind of spoke about what competitive eating means to him, and as you may know, a lot of people out there criticize competitive eating.
Yeah, I don't really know. It's interesting to me what is behind it. Like, if it was a famine culture, like if it was medieval times, I would participate in that too, just because I would be guaranteed a bunch of food that day.
Sure. Well, you know, like this guy Ryan Reynolds from the Huffington Post says competitive eating is another example of Western gluttony at a time when many others around the world are starving. So I guess that's kind of the argument against competitive eating.
Which is also what Erica Wide said, you know, there are people starving in other places.
But I have a clip of Crazy Legs kind of arguing a different point, so let me play that.
What do you think competitive eating says about American culture?
The interesting thing is what it doesn't say, meaning the obesity epidemic, the world hunger situation, these are very complex adult issues. And competitive eating has very little to do with that. We serve really 60 large meals a year with no leftovers or very few. We have an altruistic component. Major League Eating gives... for instance, Thanksgiving. You know, Wild Turkey 81 is a sponsor of a whole turkey eating contest. And I got to give away 81 turkeys to City Harvest, a food bank in New York.
Yeah, and
all right, so he did some good stuff.
Yeah, and we like City Harvest here, too.
Sure, yeah. I once gave to City Harvest from the leftovers of Heritage Foods' 200 pigs, but I kept giving them these meaty bones. kind of thinking that the City Harvest chef would be like the great chefs we work with that are like, ah, this meaty bone, I can make 50 things with it. Instead, we got banned by City Harvest. They were like, why do you keep sending us bones? I was like, they're meaty bones. Anyway. Mm.
Well, another thing he said on the show, which is a tie into today, is during competitive eating competitions, you're not allowed to use the word puke or vomit. You have to say things like return to sender or other things. You're just not allowed to say it because they think, you know.
We're going to talk about this, but that is a, if you read the games and rules for Beer Fest that was published by Roberta's, the spillers and dribblers will be disqualified or penalized. They talk about that. There's no coming back out. And then, you know, if you are returning to sender, you know, you basically have to do another whatever Diablo beer bong and start over.
Oh, boy.
Well, we were really honored to have Paul Bertoli come in. He is, you know, one of the big guys. Like, when people mention all the people that have come through Chez Panisse, he's like one of the top two or three people that's always mentioned. He also helped put Oliveto on the map, which is a very successful restaurant, also in, I think that's in Oakland. And then he went on to start one of the more ambitious curing programs in the United States. It's called Frat Mani, meaning done by the hands, and that's sold at Whole Foods and all that, and it is actually a very good representation of what charcuterie, salami, things of that nature should be like. So the fact that he came in and gave us some time was really fantastic. So this is actually pre-recorded a couple days earlier, but why don't we take a break and then cut to the clip, and then we'll come back with the entire team. Drinking team from Heritage. Edition of the main course, broadcasting out of Roberta's Restaurant, 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And we are very honored to have one of the culinary gastronomic titans in American history. We have Mr. Chef Paul Bertoli in studio. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Patrick.
God, I don't even know where to begin. It's such an honor to have you here. Tell us a little bit, maybe just for our archives, summarize a little bit about your history. I mean, you were the founding chef of the mighty Oliveto in Oakland, right?
Not exactly the founding chef. I came into the restaurant about halfway through its life after having spent about 10 years with Alice Waters at Chez Panisse as the chef of the restaurant. Mm-hmm. And so I joined Oliveto in 1991 and became a partner after that time, and really kind of not so much birthed what I'm doing right now, but elaborated an idea that I've been working on for a long time and mm-hmm. was part of my heritage as a Italian-American son of a Italian pork butcher. At any rate, I'm now the founder and creative developer, cure master, we call me, mm-hmm. at Fromani Handcrafted Foods in Berkeley, and we specialize in traditional Italian cured meats, in particular dry fermented salami, mm-hmm. pancetta, cooked sausages. We have a prepared food line that has developed over the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Well, very interesting. But just to conclude the whole historical thing, I mean, you must have been working with a lot of great people at Chez Panisse. I mean, that was a very interesting time for the restaurant, and then also Oliveto. So did you know that you wanted to start a big cure, a national curing presence back then? And were you already doing things in the back kitchens there? And was it even legal to experiment?
In all the restaurants I've ever worked in, I've kept curing cellars. And mm-hmm. At my house, too. I'm a garagiste, you could say, of cured meat, in so much as I excavated my my under basement and put a cellar in, and actually created some of the salamis that we're making today. There, experimented with them. No, it was not legal. It still isn't legal. Mm-hmm. What came of that, I think, was the acknowledgement that what people wanted in America was something that looked like the past, not so much like the present or the future. Mm-hmm. That is, they wanted traditional cured meat, salamis, prosciuttos, those kinds of things that they recognized as delicious in the old world, and that had sort of been lost with what's happened in the last 50 years in the American meat system and how it's manifest in delicatessens and butcher shops.
And would you say that's just a lack of culture, or would you say that's a kind of hyper-hygienic kind of pasteurization and blitz out all taste? I mean, what would you blame the lack of kind of taste in charcuterie in America in the past 50 years until you came along?
I think there was a structural shift in the production of meat in America when the diversification of family farms and the economic pressures on farmers created a condition where they had to give up what they were doing to principally four large organizations that dominate the meat system right now, mm-hmm. the commodity meat system. That's one thing. The passing on of traditions because of old world sausage makers who are generationally, you know, there was a shift, mm-hmm. and some of that knowledge has not been carried forth. And I think also because of that, we're seeing just less of an interest in, not so much just less of an interest in diversity, is that these two factors kind of helped squeeze things down into, reduce things down into very few choices. Mm-hmm. We call it the trifecta, the roast beef, turkey, and ham, you know. And when
the
I was
boar
working...
Said, you know, we're two blocks away from the Boar's Head factory right here, so that's funny. And they actually helped us move the containers in place with their machinery, so it was funny. I don't think they knew what they were helping, you know, place right. in forever, but...
Right.
So, and what was the greatest challenge for you to kind of industrialize the production numbers? Because, I mean, doing something in a kitchen versus, you know, being able to supply stores around the nation, I mean, how was that a challenge, and what was the biggest learning experience?
Not so much on the level of production. I knew that I swore to myself that I would never, first of all, compromise the sourcing, you uh-huh. know, that we're only going to farms and farmers that are raising their animals on pasture or in hoop mm-hmm. barns, and we're a single species company right now. We deal with hogs alone, and that I wouldn't compromise either the means of production, that is the way that we're going to make the product slowly. By that it's not that's kind of become a trite term a little bit, you know, or overused term, but it means that we do a very slow, low temperature fermentation. We work only with fresh meat, and we de-sinew the meat by hand. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of hand work. That's why our company is called Handcrafted. We use natural casings, which have their own idiosyncrasies. You need to hand tie those because you can't trust them evenly. You can't count on the casing actually holding the product if it's not trussed properly. And there's a long, slow aging process. So even as we scaled up, I had to find ways in which we would not compromise those ideas, and we haven't. We haven't gotten huge. Mm-hmm. In fact, we have a fairly limited dry salami production right now. It's very special, kind of reserve product, we consider it to be. And the big challenge for me was moving from an 18 by 20 foot cellar to a 10,000 square foot production kitchen, mm-hmm. and how it would play out to actually have to condition the air, you know, in such a way, to learn the systems, to learn how to use machines, have them be in service to you rather than you're being in service to them. Mm-hmm. So I purchased machines, for instance, that mimic the hand chopping that I learned in Italy. When you make a salami, you know, from a hog, you use knives.
Did you import these machines from Italy?
Some of them I did. Some, you know, my chopper, for instance, I found in an old sausage plant in Chicago, and I rebuilt it and put a frequency drive on it so I could chop 30 RPM or 3,000 RPM, and it's like knives. I went to small artisan machine makers in the Po Valley in Italy. You know, they specialize in tools to produce certain kinds of salamis and cured meats that are very specialized.
Now, tell me a little bit about the product. What is your anchor product, and what are the products that you're most proud of, you know, that you produce now? Because I know it's a very wide array of products.
Right. It's So our core product line consists of six different types of dry salami. Mm-hmm. We have smaller formats. We have a Salametto, Salametto Picante. We have what we call a Nostrano salami, which is my version of a delicious salami I had in Mantova one time. My grandfather used to make Soprasata Vicentina from the north, and so I make that. Now it's a clove-scented, very large format salami. Mm-hmm. And because I did a lot of, I had real formative experience in outside of Florence in 1980 when I spent a year there cooking and traveling around with these Norcinos, these pork butchers who would come to the farms and slaughter the animal for the family for the year and put up all the cuts. So I traveled around with them, learned how to slaughter, learned how to cut the Italian way and cure. So I have a Toscano salami. Mm-hmm. We have also a really interesting pancetta that we do in a particular way that I think is unusual for most pancetta production. We cure it flat and then we roll it. Mm-hmm. We have a cooked line. We have mortadella that's made from all prime cuts, no trims, in a particle reduction process, which is very different than chopping very fast and emulsifying. You get a very interesting texture. And mm-hmm. We make a cooked salami. We make a line of cooked sausages. And we have also a new product called lonza. Mm. Like a loin product, a couple of hams. We work with a...
You do prosciuttos?
We only cooked hams.
Okay, right, because yeah. Prosciuttos, that's seems very few and far between the people. One of our sponsors is Sam Edwards, who sure. does that. And then, you know, of course, the quercia, but there's very few people that have that, because it takes, what, years, right, for a ham to cure at times?
Good 14, 16 months, mm-hmm. yeah. Yeah, that's a lot of time to hang inventory.
Yeah, when you so you do the hams. That must also be very useful for the farmers, because I know finding a ham outlet can be very difficult. So you make a kind mm-hmm. of cooked ham?
It is, and we do. We make two different whole muscle hams, one from the knuckle, one from the inside, outside, and top round of the pig, a rosemary ham, beautiful ham. But, you know, my business model was based on the use of the whole hog, because mm-hmm. what so impressed me when I was in Italy was the way in which this animal could be economically used in so many ways to feed people throughout the year. I was so impressed by that that I thought, you know, could I build a business on this? And, you know, and for 4.5 years, we've been in business for a little over 5 years now. I haven't been able to do that because it's a question of balancing the parts. You mm-hmm. know, how if I have need of 16 legs, then what am I going to do with all the shoulders if I don't need them? Mm-hmm. So I've kind of designed the line of products to be able to realize that, to be able to go to the farmer, you know, and help the farmer out because they're struggling out there in a big way. Another core value of our company is to really, like, support the farmers and try and help with the regeneration of the American heartland, you mm-hmm. know, when it comes to animal agriculture.
Which people forget because of the Eat Local, you know, people in New York forget that the heartland still remains Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, right. places like that. So
right.
my business is committed to helping those farms as well.
Yeah. Yes, exactly, and we're, that's why I'm here, really, mm-hmm. to see you today. I mean, we so much admire what you're doing and feel that we share your values.
Vice versa.
But that whole hog idea is really a potent one because it allows a lot of good things to happen. You know, it allows those farmers who may not sell all their parts and have to sell them a discount on the commodity market. They're making mm-hmm. $24, $30 a head right now at $7 mm-hmm. a corn bushel. $7 a bushel corn.
Yeah, which is double what they, you know, might have paid a few years ago.
Right.
Or more, yeah.
Right.
Now, in the time, my last question, I guess, or one of my last, is in French tradition, it almost doesn't matter with the pig. It seems like a lot of the sausages are just a fat-to-lean ratio, and they use a lot of the cuts into just one generic or two generic sausages, whereas the Italians seem every cut has its own deep tradition. Mm-hmm. Is that the case? I mean, is the French tradition fewer products, and it's just a fat lean ratio, or is that not the case? I mean, could you use any cut for a sausage, for instance?
No.
Like, no, right? No. I mean, it's very cut specific.
Definitely. And I don't know that I can agree with the idea that the French
do that
because, okay. I, you know, studying the tradition of terrines and galantines and pâtés, and, you know, they're very specific fats that you mm-hmm. use for those, and
okay.
and the hams and salamis as well. But, yeah, I mean, I think about it again on this whole hog concept that and what I've learned from studying this for a very long time is that each cut, each muscle has a quality, it has a color, it has a texture, Has a fat lean content, as you say, and should be used, you know, appropriately for special products.
Very. Yeah. So we got to have you on again. I mean, this was just the last minute. We're about to have Damon do his show, Speakeasy. But can you just tell our listeners how they can learn more about Framani's products?
Sure.
Or buy it?
Certainly go to framani.com.
Framani?
Correct.
Okay.
That's right. And that's probably the best way.
But there's stores all over the place, right? I mean, I see it more and more on charcuterie boards at restaurants and in great stores. So
yeah, the list is pretty long right now. We have a national reach with our company, and the website has certainly many addresses, perhaps not all, but we service specialty retail, food service, restaurants and hotels, and mom and pop shops and, you know, big and small, everywhere.
Bringing culture back to America. We lost it temporarily, but it's not dead. So thank you. It's a real honor. Thank you so much for coming on, and we hope to have you again to be a guest for the whole show.
Thanks, Patrick.
In studio, Andrea Trabucco-Campos.
Hello.
Shauna Chalk-Goldman.
What up?
Bill Saxelby.
How's it hanging?
Jack Inslee. Patrick Martin. Games and rules for Beer Fest. Precision. 10 teams compete. Competing teams pulled out of a hat. Head-to-head competition. 6 teams will compete across 3 tables, and then 4 teams compete across 2 tables. 1 judge per table. Top 6 teams move forward. You got the Flip Cup game. Got quarters. Got Pong. Baby Bud Beeramid. And that concludes the Precision round, followed by the Power round. Triple Beer Bong. Timed. Monkey Chug. Keg stand, and then the glory round, the five-legged race. Welcome in studio, everybody. Bill, let's start with you. We'll start with our ringer. We will start with our ringer, our biggest guy. He, by the way, has worked with Heritage before, in case the rules. Judge, he worked on our maple syrup. He's the director of our maple syrup video. Billy, tell us.
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, the one thing that I'm really looking forward to doing is just getting out there competing, doing good today. And, you know, back in college, I did win a apartment-style beer pong tournament, so I'm hoping that I can bring out some of that old glory today.
So now, what does it take to be as good as you are? Because I've heard you're good. Like, everyone tells me. Your family, I was with them yesterday, they're like, Billy's going to do good for you. I was like, I know he will.
I don't know if it's good that we're celebrating how much I can drink or, like, the amount of beer I can consume, but I think it just all comes down to, like, me just being huge.
Yeah. You are 6'6".
Yes.
How much do you weigh?
210.
210.
So it's a lot. There's a lot of room for beer to go in me.
Very nice. And I see you're wearing your special shirt.
I am. This is the Power Bear sweater. Patrick and I have a good story about this. When we went to the national championship game to watch Texas play Alabama, we unfortunately lost, but this sweater brought about a huge change in the tide in the game. We started rubbing the bear, and Texas began to, you know, push for a comeback in the game. But hopefully that I can unleash the power of the bear today.
We need it.
Oh, yeah, dude. Big time.
Also in studio, Shauna Chalk-Goldman and her boyfriend. Now, Shauna runs the Heritage Meat Shop, and Andrea runs the mail order program for Heritage. So welcome, guys. Tell us about the competition. Are you excited or what?
I'm really excited. And for me and Andrea, this is a very special day for us. Yesterday was our second year anniversary, and we actually met at a beer pong table.
Really?
Wasted. So I'm hoping to replicate that
well
today.
Well, and not the wasted part. The
I mean, it's inevitable.
Yeah, I think.
Andrea's like, I'd like to partially help with the monkey chug. I'm like, by partially, what do you mean?
Guys, we have a caller question about Beer Fest.
Uh-oh.
Awesome.
Bring it in.
You're on the air.
Hello? Am I on?
Yeah, you're on.
Hey, Dad.
Hey, I'm just calling in because I want to make sure that Patrick, after last night, is going to be actually capable of being able to compete.
I know. Thank you so much for calling in, Bill. I'm a little worried because you really pushed me to the edge last night.
And vice versa. I've been on the exercise machine for an hour, left my ass off.
Oh, man. It was
trying to get it out.
Oh, brother. How are you feeling this morning?
I'm good now. I wasn't very good when I first got up, but I'm good now.
Dad, you're just doing your part. You were just, you were helping train his liver for today.
Exactly. All right.
Thanks so much for calling in.
You sound great.
Thanks so much for calling in, Bill. Just for the listeners to know, Anne, my fiance, had her wedding shower. So then the guys have what I called a vodka bath. It was like a wedding bath, and it was like five guys basically drinking vodka shots. I told everyone it was a Jewish tradition, and it would be a form of anti-Semitism if they didn't participate. And then by the final round, they were just like, was there any truth to that? Were you BSing us from the beginning? But so now let's talk about this. There's the precision round, but the real one is the power round. Triple beer bong, monkey chug, and keg stand. Like, who is going to compete in those? And I mean, what are your specialties, Bill?
Well, I mean, I used to be able to be okay at like drinking beer fast, but I kind of that skill fell by the wayside after about age 20. So I don't know. I'm thinking that I'll be able to do quantity over speed, so I think that I'm going to handle the monkey chug. Because it's 2 liters of beer. It's a lot of beer, but I think I can handle that pretty well. And sound like Jack, who's the Radio Smith, was going to handle the beer bonging for us.
Triple beer bong.
Triple beer bong. All right, you're doing monkey chug. That leaves you, Shauna, for the keg stand.
It does, and I feel okay about it. I feel as a designated lady of the group. To pick me up may be a little easier than everyone else who averages about 6 foot.
Not with all that beer in you, sister.
You're right. But it may be coming out, so hopefully not.
It's just so you know, the keg stand, that's one player per team, timed, cannot spit. Second you spit or tap out, the timer stops. Longest keg stand time wins. I hope the beer is not cold. That can like burn the back of your throat.
It's going to be cold, and it's not going to be good, but
I think they're using Bud Light. I think they're using Bud Light.
It's Bud Light throughout the competition, except for the baby Buds. Those are going to be Bud Heavies.
The Diesel?
Yeah. They don't make that. Well, no. I like this. This is the five-legged race. It's the glory race.
Oh,
maybe, Jack, you have some back music for this. This is published by Roberta. The full team participates. This is if we get to the third round. Starting at Roberta's garden gate, team race up the sidewalk towards White Street, where they pass one judge as they cross the street. Teams trace back on the opposite sidewalk towards Bogart, where they pass around a second judge.
Oh my God.
Teams cross the street and then head back to Roberta's gate, where they take a funnel from a third judge. One team member does an El Diablo.
You can do it!
Before walking across the balance beam to finish the line, glory follows. Now, there's probably some people who just moved to America that do not know what a Diablo is. That's a funnel with a can of Modelo and a shot of tequila with hot sauce.
I'm feeling good about that because I don't know if you remember during the World Cup, Patrick, you and I think had 2 Diablos each while watching the World Cup at like 10 a.m. and then went back to work and did just fine.
Did
so,
we?
Yeah, we did. So
I think Heritage lost a lot of money that day. I think I sent some pallets to some wrong cities that day. But there's actually, this is the second year they're doing this. Winning team, $500 cash. And then, by the way, there is free Fernet at the bar around the street for the 7 losing teams.
Awesome. Good. I look forward to that.
So now, Bill, you went to a big Texas school. So were drinking games just like going on every time you were to walk down the road there?
Well, I mean, nobody was like doing them on the street corner or anything. But yeah, it was like every apartment party, it was just like, hey, flip cup, beer pong, quarters. So the precision round, I'm very familiar with.
Yeah.
So
that's gold for you.
That's gold, baby.
Now, Andrea, you're Italian. It strikes me that the Italians do not have so many all you can eat and all you can drink. Like, is there an all you can drink wine competition or something that you've ever known about?
No, you just drink all the time. You drink at home.
Yeah,
you drink at dinner. You eat all you can every night. But I think, I mean, there's such a thing as the Sagra, which are festivals that little towns have them, and you're celebrating one typical food of the town. And during those, you just go all out. And it's hefty beer. It's not Bud Light. It's, you know, Moretti or a little bit heavier. So but there's not such a culture. Although, you know, we could hold our own.
No, I'm sure you guys definitely eat throughout the day. I mean, even like bus drivers drink at the auto grill, like as they're driving
I
students.
I mean, our coffee is corrected. So yeah. It's corrected with Fernet.
Yes,
exactly. I always remember my grandpa going and ordering the corrected, you know, caffè corretto.
So a coffee by itself is wrong.
It's very wrong. Just not accepted.
So are you guys worried at all? I mean, China, I mean, you weigh, you know, like 110 pounds.
Thank you.
Did I say 110? No, wait, sorry. You weigh 110 pounds. Are you a little nervous at all? I mean,
you know, I have to say, before I came here, I was actually on the phone with my mother because I was really nervous, and she started Googling techniques for lining your stomach so you don't get sick.
Oh, my God.
And all I had to say, if I were ever doing this with my mom in high school, it would be a different story. So I'm glad that we emotionally and intellectually are on another level at a time like this, because she did say that Pepto-Bismol is good to take a little bit to line your stomach and stay hydrated. Mm. And she also said, like you suggested, that never to drink between events. Mm. Let your body rest a little bit.
I think I learned that from Bill. Well, we have Jack. Are you worried at all? Are your parents? Is your mom like driving in or whatever?
It's par for the course for me.
The huge. No,
my training is mostly in whiskey and scotch, so we'll see how this works out for me.
And just for the record, I drank a lot of vodka yesterday, maybe 3/4 of a bottle of Belvedere vodka. How about you? Just to see how we all play out.
I think we had a couple of cocktails, you know, vermouth, a little bit of whiskey, but not nothing heavy.
Nothing crazy. No. Congratulations on your second year anniversary, by the way.
Thank you.
2 years.
Jack, the clap.
Andrea, you're a lucky man.
Yes, I am.
Billy, did you drink last night?
I did. Thinking, you know, it would be good to kind of get the liver working out a little bit beforehand. And, you know, I was watching UT football. Unfortunately, they lost. But
yeah, that was ugly to Baylor.
Oh, yeah, dude. Not good.
Not good.
But so, you know, I used that, you know, that defeat to fuel my energy for drinking more beer yesterday and getting ready for today.
Well, this has been an absolutely fantastic show. I hope people have learned a lot today. We had Paul Bertoli on. We had the Week in Review. Actually, it's so funny. We just talked about beer competition drinking. And after this is the lawyer that prosecuted Jack in the Box for their salmonella outrage. So, you know, there's high and low on HRN. Yeah, they're serious and not so serious. But I do want to give a quick shout out to the teams that will be competing, because these teams are really part of the whole movement. Pearls, Momo Sushi Shack, the Death Killers, who've organized some historic events in this backyard here, including a little mini motorbike crash course where they like jump through hoops of fire. The Narrows, Roberta's has a pizza team and a back of the house team, Heritage. The Meat Hook, Good Company, Anchored In, and Italy. So we've got our hands full. People, if you're at home, pray for us. Wish us luck.
Confirmation, Jimmy Carboni will be here.
Oh, very good.
I think he's going to be a judge.
Will beer here? Is that what you said?
Yes.
Anyway, well, thanks so much for listening, everybody. Thank you to Mr. Bill Saxelby for calling in. We'll see you next week.
Listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network.
You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.